Good evening. Thank you, David, and thank you everyone for the opportunity. I should say I've been in the nuclear industry for more than 40 years. I was responsible for the British Energy nuclear fleet for many years before I went to North America in 1997 and spent 20 years there as the chief executive officer of the Bruce Nuclear Facility, which is the world's largest nuclear plant. And I tell you that because I you know, whilst I agree with everything that Robin said, which you might expect for someone who understands the industry, there are a few lessons to be learned, I think, from my experience that kind of put some practical spin on this. Let me tell you that when I went to Canada, the government of Ontario, and it's a great case study, decided they wanted to close all of their coal plants. And in one of the slides, if you might remember, that Robin showed, it showed how flexible gas operated in the sector to deal with the peaking load demand, etc. Well, in Canada, that role was taken up by coal. And the government decided that they wanted to remove coal from the equation and create an emission-free energy production environment. One of the other things that Robin also said was the nuclear output was stable. I used to say the elephant can't dance. We provided baseload energy, but people didn't consume it in that manner. They consumed it in a peaky manner, morning and evening, and that peak was taken up by coal. And so the challenge was, how could we remove coal and put an emission-free source in place? One of the strategies was, of course, to introduce renewables, wind and solar. And so they introduced the Green Energy Act to do that. But in reality, the maximum commitment, if you like, came from nuclear plants. It came from a combination of returning plants that had been dormant back to service, extending the life of existing units, and actually finding a way to flex the additional generation. Now, one of the things, again, I think a good case study is the Bruce Nuclear Facility, which was built as the world's largest in the 70s, actually did have cogen capability with it. It was built into the design because the boilers and the reactor were oversized so that there would be an excess of steam, which the turbines couldn't accept. And so a lot of that steam was diverted to an energy park that sat right next to the plant. It had things like hydroponics facilities, any industry that had a demand for high steam, chemical plants, hydroponic facilities, et cetera, were provided steam from the nuclear plant directly. They were built adjacent to the site. We also produced hydrogen off-peak because for those people that understand my industry, the best combination of nuclear was nuclear power with hydro facilities, pump storage facility, because the logic was that overnight when demand was low, we would use the energy from the nuclear plant to pump the water uphill. And then in the morning when it was a peak demand, we would let the hydro facilities produce power. So what we're talking about here in Robin's paper, and frankly, this kind of futuristic view, is not all innovation that's never been done before or has worked before, but what we're actually doing this time is designing it in a thoughtful way. One of the examples I'll give you is that at the Bruce site right now, the Bruce facility is being paid by government to dump steam up into the atmosphere when there's excess generation because there's nowhere to put the steam. So not only is there waste heat by design, but there's waste heat by economy because the government want to make sure there's enough base load when they require it. But in times when they don't require it, they pay Bruce Power to simply discharge that steam into the atmosphere as waste heat. So it makes the point that Robin said, which is if you think about the characteristics of baseload nuclear and merge it with our consumption habits, we actually do not consume it the way that nuclear makes it. So even if we weren't looking at the attributes of waste heat, which I absolutely think we should, we need to understand that many of these clean technologies, we need a system-wide approach to it. We have intermittent wind. I always refer to it as the elephant and the butterfly. You have the elephant of nuclear that can't dance, and you have the butterfly of wind that you don't know where it's going to fly to next. So without some storage capability or some way to harness that, it is inevitable that we will create waste. And so as we're looking at building back better, I totally agree with this notion of building new generation 3 or 4 plants that have that flexibility. And I can tell you the one thing I didn't buy in Robin's story was that he suggested there is only the EDF option, which I would obviously disagree with, since we have a different option and it uses UK fuel from Westinghouse. And so there are other options that can create a UK-centric, flexible, large nuclear. But I do not disagree with the notion that we need everything. I've referred to this challenge as our going to the moon challenge. For us to actually create a net zero will require all of the imagination, innovation, and commitment that we can muster. This is a complete transformation of our energy sector, and it has to be viewed as such. It can't be incremental decision-making. We have to have a grand plan. And quite honestly, I applaud the 10-point plan, but it's not enough, and there's not enough funding behind it to deliver it. There's enough imagination and vision in it, but what there isn't is a cohesive plan to get there. And the industry needs that. The supply chain needs that. Our young people who we need to pursue careers need that clarity, so that if you can make a lifelong commitment. As I said, this is my 50th year in the industry. It's been a great career. But if we're going to attract the brightest and the best, which this industry will require, we need to give them a sense of a career that looks like mine. It gives them that long-term, challenging, exciting atmosphere. In the same way that the going to the moon speech by John F. Kennedy sent recruitment at NASA through the roof and had them achieve a goal that at the very time he made the speech, they had no idea how they were going to get there, and yet they did. And that for me is the challenge. I applaud the work that the Royal Society are doing because it's thought leadership. It gives the government a joined up piece of work and it gives them a plan. And I've always said, if you don't know where you're going, any road will take you there. But that's had us stumbling and moving around for at least 20 years. Because we are very fortunate that we've been able to extend the life of the existing fleet. I can tell you, when I was responsible for the fleet, I left here in 1997, believing that by 2010, most of the AGRs would be gone. And it's a credit to the operators to be able to eke out the life where they are. But these Generation 2 plants should have been replaced more than a decade ago. And now we are against a very short timeline, not only to replace them, but to actually introduce this new technology with an integrated plan. And so I'm optimistic because there is a vision, but a vision without action is a dream. And I'm just hoping that as a country, we are up to the challenge that we've signed up for. Thank you.